It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In recent weeks, President Trump has painted a picture of a country plagued by street violence.
The violence is fueled by dangerous rhetoric from far-left politicians that demonize our nation and demonize our police.
Joe Biden countered with Trump.
He can't stop the violence because for years he's fomented it.
Dr. Paul Johnson is a professor of communications and rhetoric at the University of Pittsburgh. His research focuses on argumentation, American politics, and race studies. Dr. Johnson, what kind of impact does political rhetoric have on political persuasion?
That's a great question, Kevin. And it's interesting because the Trump presidency has sort of changed scholarly views on this a little bit. I think for a long time, folks were obsessed with this view that they called the rhetorical presidency. And within this view, they imagined that the president's words had the capacity to set the agenda and also influence the decisions that people would sort of make on either side of a particular agenda. What we're seeing in the Trump era is more of a sign that the president's choice of topics can kind of set the agenda, especially as the mainstream media reports it, because the only people that are as obsessed with Twitter as Trump are a lot of the sort of like, you know, mainstream heavy players in the media who get their news from Twitter and sort of use it to follow stories. And so the president can set the agenda in terms of what gets discussed by the media very strongly depending on what he wants to talk about.
Can you give us a specific recent example of that persuasive political rhetoric?
Depending on the timeline you want, I mean, immigration was not one of the most salient issues in American politics, and it wasn't really an issue that the Republican Party was seeking to put at the center of the agenda until Trump ran for president. And that turned it from one of several issues on the burner into maybe, you know, one of the premium issues for the, you know, 2015-2016 Republican primary, and kind of carrying through into today with the 2018 talk about, you know, immigrant caravans and whatnot.
Dr. Johnson, we've heard exchanges between presidential nominees in the past, but are these some of the most heated back and forth? And if so, is that because of the sensitivity of the issue of racial injustice and street protests?
It feels particularly intense to us because the political norm in the United States from, you know, the latter half of the 20th century through the early part of the 21st was, you know, relatively civil, conventional, polite exchanges between candidates with some notable exceptions. But that's really a kind of historical outlier. And if you go back to the 19th century, the earlier part of the 20th century, you know, to say politics ain't beanbag would be, you know, really understating the matter. So I do think that to the extent that those sort of norms about civility and decorum, I mean, they are kind of becoming less and less heavy norms, I think in part because the country is having a serious conversation about racial injustice and inequality. And those are not conversations that ultimately can happen very politely, it seems, because they get to very basic questions about, you know, who America is as a country.
Was America already moving toward this divisive political rhetoric before Donald Trump?
No question. There's a great book by a Mann and Ornstein. Ornstein's a sort of former conservative who used to work at the American Enterprise Institute. And they wrote this book called It's Worse Than It Looks, that was about increases in polarization in the American political system. And they traced, you know, these trends actually to the 1980s and the 1990s, and especially the nationalization of politics that was engineered by the Republican Party under Newt Gingrich. Some of the greatest evidence of this was when, you know, Bill Clinton was impeached for what I think we would understand very clearly, you know, as a highly problematic abuse of power and sexual harassment, but then was sort of framed as a kind of moral problem by a Republican Party. And this was against the president who had endorsed a lot of their beliefs on questions of welfare reform and supported legislation like the Defense of Marriage Act. And even that, you know, set of behaviors by Clinton and policy proposals weren't really enough to, you know, get the Republican Party to play nice with him. And so if you can kind of set that as a starting point, at least kind of in the more modern era after the Cold War ends, and from then on, there's, you know, lots of increases in the use of the filibuster, And so this heavy polarization had sort of really taken root by the time Obama was elected. And it has longer roots than just Trump. Trump is someone who's just well-positioned to, I think, exploit the polarization that's happening in American politics and sort of lean into its intensities.
President Trump has leaned heavily on a law and order message, calling mostly peaceful protesters, quote, Antifa or anti-fascists, anarchists, and agitators, end quote. Do you think this is leading to increased violence against protesters?
I do think that it has some kind of relationship. It's always hard to establish a one-to-one kind of causal chain when you talk about what people say. And so one hesitates to, you know, point to a single speech or a single performance or anything like that. But as I sort of said earlier, presidents can choose what topics are the most salient in the public discussion. And Trump's decision to paint this country as a country facing instability, where police officers are constantly at threat of their lives from, you know, violent left-wing communist agitators, you know, that really has for some of the population increased the sense that the American way of life is in danger and that they need to do something about it.
Finally, what kind of connection, is there a connection to mildly violent statements like fighting for the soul of our nation or calling Democrats radical liberals? Does that have anything to do with political violence?
Yes, I think that there is a kind of important relationship there. And it's about how one is thinking about one's relationship to the country. You know, throughout the kind of what's called the consensus period in the 1950s, 60s, starts to break down in the early 70s, America has this common enemy in the Soviet Union and, you know, international communism. And that played a really important stabilizing role. I think a lot of scholars of history, you know, say you wouldn't necessarily have gotten the gains in civil rights that we've gotten, you know, if there hadn't been this kind of shared national investment in showing the world, showing the Soviet Union that America really, you know, meant what it stood for. As we get further and further away from that geopolitical situation, this idea that the nation is in it together, you know, kind of declines as a kind of taken for granted assumption. And as a consequence, you get the need for people rhetorically to assert their ownership over the nation. So I think while, you know, you're right to say that it sort of seems only mildly violent, because it does kind of just feel like or look like patriotism in a way, I think the deeper structure there is actually pretty worrisome, because when people are making claims about ownership over the nation, that's actually a very anti-democratic argument. You know, it says that we can't actually even have a debate about what the nature of this country is. And that's a scary prospect for democracy.
Dr. Paul Johnson is a professor of communication and rhetoric at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 21-year-old Marquis J.B. Brown, a linebacker on Duquesne University's football team, died in October 2018 when he jumped through a broken window on the 16th floor of Duquesne's Brodie Hall. His mother has been on a hunger strike for nearly 10 weeks, seeking answers to her questions about her son's death. WESA's Ariel Worthy has been reporting on the story and has spoken with Ms. Brown. Ariel, what is agreed upon as to the circumstances to her son's death?
So far, what they do agree on is that he fell from the 16th floor window in Brodie Hall, and they all agree that there were four people in the room with him, who were two on-campus officers, a security guard, and an RA. And it's also agreed upon that he was clearly under the influence, and the school says that, you know, only marijuana was in his system, but his behavior does show otherwise. Where the questions lie in is what happens while he's in the room with the four other people. There is no cameras or any kind of video evidence that shows exactly what happened. So that's actually where the questions actually lie in, what happens right before he falls out of the window.
So she has three requests, we understand, of the university's: full access to the school's files and reports, body cameras for Duquesne University officers to address that camera issue you were talking about, and mental health crisis de-escalation training for campus police. Duquesne's president has issued a statement saying they've agreed to all these. Does Ms. Brown concur that Duquesne agree to all three of those?
No. She actually, as recently, I think it was about, it was sometime last week, she was actually saying that, you know, they should have body cameras by now. That should be the bare minimum that the school has done, and they don't have body cameras now, or at least she has not seen them. She also maintains that, you know, she has not had access to the files, and what she's asking for is full access, as in she does not want to have to continue going through red tape like she's going through right now to see the files about her son's death.
During her long hunger strike, how much time has she spent at Freedom Corner in the Hill District?
It's where she started, and she's been in this for over 60 days now, and she spent most of that time at Freedom Corner before she moved to Duquesne's entrance, and even then she still had a setup at Freedom Corner. So, I mean, it's safe to say she spent all of her days there since she's begun this hunger strike.
And Freedom Corner has obviously become a special place for her. Let's have a listen to your report.
As hurtful as it is, I could not rely on my attorney to be my advocate for what I knew I needed to do. And so, without a thought, I just went into motion, throwing things in a suitcase, grabbing my chair. I got here, like I said, I sat there for 2 days in the element, night and day. I would get up, go to the bathroom, right at the hotel down the street, come back. And I would sit there, and then on day two, towards the evening, Brother Ash is what Pittsburgh calls him, so happened to be doing a photo shoot. And he was looking at all my display of pictures of my son. He said, "What's going on? What is this?" And I explained to him, you know, this is my son. And I'm not leaving here at Freedom Corner until I get answers for what happened to my son. And he said, "Well, who knows that you're out here?" And I said, "Nobody."
Donnie Kite, DonnieKyte.
Ashley Woodson, AshleyWoodson. We was all on it like, what is you doing here all alone? You need some people, you need some coverage, you need something.
Exactly.
And since we're some people in the community who know some people, you know, it just, God was all in it. This is like a spiritual journey, if you will. He's sending a message that she will die on this corner until she gets the answers that she needs.
So it started with a rocking chair to this very tent we sitting under. That was the first thing. Somebody came the next day and was like, "You need shade." And so they bought a tent. Then this is the very first cooler someone bought me. You know, I didn't have a cooler. And they bought me a cooler. And then from there, the whole community of Pittsburgh just started to rally around me. And now we have a tent village, a little cozy four tent room. Overhang.
You know, anytime there's an injustice to us as a people, we come here. This corner gets attention, the attention that it deserves. You know, we have to start somewhere.
I'll tell you the significance of this corner. It's called Freedom Corner for a reason, because years and years ago, our ancestors stood on this very corner to stop them from coming further up to the Hill District, because this was the lower hill. All of that down there was the lower hill. And they were trying to come up, further up. But our people stood here on this corner in front of bulldozers and everything and put their lives on the line to stop them right here. They said, "You're not going no further." Mm-hmm. This is why this is Freedom Corner. This is why they call this Freedom Corner, because this is where the people took a stand at.
I drink a lot of vitamin water. I drink water, vitamin water. I take potassium iron liquefied that I put droplets in my water. But no solid food, no meal substitutes. I don't do any of those because I'm not here for that. I'm here on a hunger strike. There's a term that Gandhi used called satyagraha, and it says truth and firmness. And that's I'm firm, and I want the truth, and I'm standing in truth and firmness. You know, I didn't know that I was the first woman here in Pittsburgh to do a hunger strike. And so I have had since others now are doing a hunger strike with me. You know, Freedom Corner takes on a life of its own. That's why I like this play. That's why it's Freedom Corner, because people should have the freedom to come and, you know, fellowship together, play their music, discuss current events, talk about civil actions. So this just represents what our ancestors hope it represents, and that is for people to come together in one spirit, on one accord, uplifting each other. It's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
WESA reporter Ariel Worthy is back with us on The Confluence. So how is Danielle Brown's health?
You can definitely tell, of course. I mean, she's lost a substantial amount of weight. I don't think she's weighing herself during this hunger strike. She did say that she has added non-dairy, non-protein shakes in her diet now just to give her some type of a little more nutrients. But she's still sticking to the water and vitamin water and just like the fresh squeezed juice. And she said the shakes are only, I think, once a day now. Like it's not something she's having like for every meal, so to say. But she's having it once a day. But it's she's still pretty much she's not eating. I mean, and, you know, she said multiple times that, you know, her body is definitely going through the starvation process. She's getting weaker and fatigued, and there's some days where she feels great. There's some days where she, you know, it's hard for her to get up in the morning. So it's definitely taking a toll on her physically.
WESA reporter Ariel Worthy, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.